from three simple principles that have a kind of informational flavor. So these closest cousins are the Jordan algebras, and I'll go into what they are exactly a bit later. So I think probably most of you are pretty familiar with the general idea of reconstructing quantum theory and the motivation behind it. So I'll just say a couple of things about that. So the current description of quantum theory, or at least most current descriptions of quantum theory, are just statements of a mathematical formalism. So a very specific and abstract set of rules for how to represent experiments and how to make predictions about events or measurement outcomes in these experiments. And so there's generally, most people think that we don't really have a fundamental explanation for why these particular principles or rules work so well in such a broad, for such a broad range of phenomena. And it just works very well. That's basically it. I'll just say, the main question is why. Why these particular rules work so well. So in general, we tend to think we understand something when we can take it apart and look at all the pieces and understand how they work, and we can put everything back together and still have something, and still have the original thing function. So for example, a TV. You might say that you understand how a TV functions if you can take the whole thing apart, play with all the transistors and everything in it, and then put it back together, maybe modify it a little bit, and you still have a functioning TV afterwards. So you can say, you can make an analogy with physical theories that you understand a physical theory when you can take it apart conceptually in terms of some more basic principles and then put it back together, maybe modify it in some consistent way and still have a good physical theory afterwards. So that's sort of the idea behind reconstructions. We want to do this for the abstract rules of quantum theory, find some more basic principles that are hopefully more intuitive or reasonable or intelligible, and get the structure back. So for example, Kepler's three laws of planetary motion, you can think of them as being just these rules that work particularly well for predicting the motions of the planets. And then the role of Newton's laws of motion and gravitation are to that you can think of them as principles from which we can get Kepler's laws. Similarly, the Lorentz transformations and Einstein's postulates. Right, so those are just two examples of this general idea. yes. Right. okay, so principles. I guess I've already said some of this already. But so one reason you might look for principles is that they dissolve the mysteries. Of quantum phenomena. And make the whole theory more intuitive. You can think of principles as hopefully guiding you into finding a more fundamental theory or finding a quantum theory of gravity and that sort of thing. So So you might think that if you have some good principles, you could combine them with some basic principles for gravity and find a theory of quantum gravity, rather than just starting with an abstract set of mathematical rules and combining those with another abstract set of mathematical rules. That would be, that's sort of the idea for why you might think principles would be good in a search for quantum gravity or more fundamental theories. And maybe more immediately or more practically, this approach might lead you into, might shed light on things like what is responsible for the power of quantum information processing and that sort of thing. So let's say, okay, so if, let's see if I can figure this out. So if we're going to talk about principles for quantum theory, I should be a little bit more precise about what I mean by what kinds of principles and by quantum theory. So one argument you could make is that quantum theory applies to such a broad range of phenomena, to so many different kinds of systems in so many different situations, that any potential principles should also apply to this very broad range of phenomena as well. So you might expect that the principles should be a little bit abstract, that they shouldn't refer to particular physical quantities in any particular experiment. So typically when we apply quantum theory, we have some particular system in mind, and we want to find the right Hilbert space or right Hilbert spaces to describe this system or this phenomenon. And we want to find some correspondence rules between operators on these Hilbert spaces and objects related to these Hilbert spaces and particular physical quantities that we're interested in related to the system. So that's, you can think of that more of a question of which complex Hilbert space. So the idea behind principles and what I mean by quantum theory is we want principles that give us complex Hilbert space. So the question is, why always complex Hilbert space? So that's sort of the reason why you think that the principles should be more abstract, right? Because we're shooting for this more abstract mathematical structure. So over the last 12 years, there have been, I guess, many works on this kind of question, starting with Lucien Tardy's axioms in 2001. And then over the years, Marcus Muller and collaborators have their own set of axioms. Giulio Chirabella and collaborators. Czeslaw Bruckner has had some axioms as well. And if you're familiar with any of those, this is sort of in that spirit, just a different set of axioms or principles. So all of those works have focused on finite dimensional quantum theory, which is what I'm going to do as well. And reversibility has played a large role, as it will in what I'll present. And so the main difference is that considering composite systems was really important in those works, but it doesn't come up at all in our principles. And we also focus on a slightly different aspect of quantum theory than the usual presentation. So in the usual way of thinking of it, we just have complex Hilbert spaces and state vectors or density matrices and unitaries. But what we're going to do is focus on the algebraic structure. So I'm going to think of quantum theory as basically the observables on a system form a C-star algebra. So if you're not familiar with what a C-star algebra is, don't worry about it for now, because the principles I'm going to present give us a slightly more general structure, and I'll tell you exactly what that is. So a C-star algebra is just a special case of a Jordan algebra. So this is, in a certain way, this has the same content. Saying that observables form a C-star algebra says the same thing as a system is described by Hilbert space, and observables are Hermitian operators, and so on. It just emphasizes a different structure. It emphasizes the algebraic structure. So let's say, so then the question of why the particular formalism of quantum theory becomes why C-star algebras, or more generally, why any kind of algebra at all for the set of observables. So the idea is to motivate the particular algebraic structure, so the product and its product and its properties. So let's see. So what I'm going to do is tell you just a bit more about Jordan algebras, and I'll define them and give you a few of their properties. And then I'm going to introduce this framework within which the principles will be stated. And then I'll state the principles within the framework and give you a few consequences of just the first two. And then after that, I'll introduce the third one and give you sort of a flavor of how you get the final product, the Jordan algebra structure, out of these principles without going into any of the proofs. So focusing on the algebraic structure of quantum theory is probably the oldest approach to trying to find principles for quantum theory, or to try and understand its mathematical structure. And so this was attempted by Pascal Jordan in 1932. And he focused in particular on sums and squares of observables on a quantum system. And he was led to define a particular kind of product in an algebra, which is now known as a Jordan algebra. So a Jordan algebra is a real So I'm going to focus on finite dimensional quantum theory, so I'll just specialize to the finite dimensional case from the very beginning. So we have a real finite dimensional vector space A, and then we define a product which I'll denote by a circle, which is commutative. Bilinear, of course. And satisfies the Jordan identity. So this is, it's a kind of a special case of the associative law. And in general, for Jordan algebra, the associative law doesn't hold, just this particular case. Should I make it bigger? Is that clear? Okay. So, let's see. Sorry? Yes.
If these were matrices,
I'll tell you in a second what it is if they're matrices. It's not the usual matrix product. So in 1934,
Jordan von Neumann and Wigner classified all the Jordan algebras over a real vector space, and there's only so many of them. So every finite dimensional Jordan algebra is a direct sum of the following. So the first case is the D by D self-adjoint real matrices, so symmetric real matrices, where D is any integer. The second case is D by D self-adjoint complex matrices. Third one is D by D self-adjoint quaternionic. Matrices. And then fourth one is the octonionic ones. The octonionic ones are
restricted to the 3x3. So for all the other cases, they can be of any size, but for the octonionic ones, they're only the 3x3s. And the last case is, they're often called the spin factors. Am I writing too small for everyone right now? Okay. So the spin factors, which have the structure of Rn plus R for arbitrary n, and they're equipped with the product A, T, So A is just the vector in Rn, and T is a vector in R, and similarly for B and U. And the way we take the product is through this symmetric product and sum here, and then this is just the standard inner product on Rn between A and B, plus this scalar. And so for these cases, the product between A and B is the anticommutator. Yeah, I wanted to gloss over that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yes.
That says Rn plus R then.
Yeah. Okay.
Got it.
Yeah. So T is an R, and U is also an R. So TV would just be the scalar T multiplied by this vector V.
And is this term spin factor a historical term? Is that what
they
call
it? I think so, yeah. I've seen it in a bunch of different places.
Presumably, it had something to do with spin.
Yeah. So I was going to mention this a bit later, but so if you think of just standard quantum theory, so case number two here with complex, and you look at the set of states, the set of normalized states, you can define analogous things for all of these theories. Each of these has a set of normalized states. And for these guys, they're balls in n dimensions. So maybe that's the reason why they're associated with spin. Yeah. So they're all two-level systems in a way. And I'll go into what that means exactly in these theories in a bit. So let's see. Okay. So this is the structure that we're shooting for. So the approach is to start with some non-algebraic structures. We won't have any kind of a product or anything like that. And we're going to look for principles that give us this product, and in particular, a product which has those properties for the Jordan algebras. So this approach goes back to the 60s, and various people have found different kinds of postulates for the Jordan algebras. Maybe I should just mention them. So if anybody's interested, there's Gunson. And then there's okay. So in order to state these principles, we need a kind of framework which is general enough to be able to state these principles and to contain theories that don't satisfy the principles, and hopefully theories that do satisfy the principles. So the framework is basically it's a set of theories that you can describe just in terms of a set of experiments in the lab, which are constructed from hypothetical or real devices. And the goal is to assign probabilities to the outcomes of measurements in these experiments in some efficient way. So there's sort of there's a largely canonical mathematical framework for these theories that Rob mentioned. They're called general probabilistic theories. And this has been rediscovered many times over the last 6 years. So I'll just briefly run through that mathematical framework, and then I can state the principles precisely.
Explain what was the Jordan's motivation for the study of this specific type of algebra? Like,
I think he was interested in justifying the von Neumann version of quantum theory, so the usual complex Hilbert space structure, and he was just focused on the algebraic structure. He wanted to motivate that algebraic structure, and the best he could do is essentially to postulate a kind of commutative product, and to focus on squares of observables rather than just all products of all observables.
Right. I mean, what's the significance of the square?
So the square is, you can define it much more operationally, because if you have an observable A, and you think of the eigenvalues of A, the square of A, you just square the eigenvalues. It sort of makes more sense operationally. When you measure A squared, the outcomes that you get are related to A very directly.
Any function of A has this
problem. Yeah, that's right. So he was just focused on the simplest function, I guess. Yeah. So as opposed to, for example, defining a sum of observables or products of non-commuting observables and that sort of thing. So if you want to justify those structures, it's harder to do it in a clean way, I guess. Yeah. But I don't know that much about his particular motivation, I guess. Okay, so in this framework, we have a laboratory setting in the background, and we don't have any particular physical theory, let alone quantum theory. And we just assume that we have some devices, and so I'm just going to abstract this experimental setup with boxes. So we have some experimental devices, and some of these devices we call preparations. And we think of them as every time the device is used, there's a system that is output by the device. You can think of it as a particle or some fields or something else entirely. Just something comes out. And it goes into a measurement or observation device. And this measurement device has several distinct events or outcomes. So these can be represented by lights on the device, or the output from a computer attached to the device, or just the pointer in some position. And the idea is that we can think of a system coming out of the preparation device, and we're interested in the probability of, so let's say this is outcome K, on the measurement device, given that we've used a particular preparation and this measurement device M. So let's say, let's call this P and this M. So that's the basic structure of these general probabilistic theories. We just have these devices and we're interested in probabilities of outcomes. And it's very convenient to associate a state with the system that comes up. And what the state represents is, it's basically a concise representation of all of these probabilities. So what we're going to do is attach a mathematical object to the measurement device that, together with the state, gives us the probability of an outcome. So let's say this is the state. So if I represent the kth outcome by mk and the state is omega, then basically you can think of this as a definition of this object. It just gives us the probability. So in general, the state should tell us the probabilities of all possible measurements that we can do on the system. And we expect that we might only need a finite number of variables in the state. So for example, the state could just be a list of all the probabilities of all possible measurements. Right, so to make things simpler, I'm going to assume that we actually only need a finite number of these probabilities. So, how do I put this? Omega. So given all possible preparation devices that we can use and all possible states that can be output by them, I'm just going to call that, so suppose that the system coming out is labeled by A. So then I'll call omega of A the set of all possible states of the system A. And one important requirement is that this set of states is convex. So maybe I should go back here. Okay. So what that means is, what I mean is that you could imagine taking a device that prepares state omega and another device that prepares state phi. So we have omega and we have phi. And we use this device, connect it to some random process that has some outcome with probability p. And if that outcome occurs, then we use this device. And if not that outcome occurs with probability 1 minus p, then we use this other device. So you can think of the device as a whole, so these two devices, omega and phi, connected together with this random process, as being another preparation. And so this is, I'm going to call this the state that this device prepares, right? So imagine that you have one device preparing omega with probability p, and then 1 minus p for the other device phi, or at least the state coming out of the device. And then we put this whole thing inside a box, and then what comes out of it is exactly a state of this form. So if we demand that we can always do this procedure, we can always carry out this procedure for any two devices, then this, the set of all possible states has to be convex. This is a convex combination of these two states. And we also demand that it's compact. And I've already assumed that we only need a finite number of probabilities. So this set is going to live in some finite dimensional real vector space. Let's call it Rn. Or let's call it A. So I'm just going to abuse notation and call the system and the vector space A, just for simplicity. Okay, so going back to measurements for a second, I already said that each outcome of a measurement device is represented by some mathematical object, so I've called it MK. And when we feed in a state, this has to be a probability, so it has to be between 0 and 1. So this is a constraint on these mathematical objects that represent these measurement events. And we also want these guys to satisfy this convexity assumption. So what we want is that MK doesn't know what's happening in this other box that we're using, where we have just a random process, basically. So it has to respect this convex combination. So from this, it's possible to show that these guys basically have to be linear functionals on our state space. So usually these guys are called effects. If they satisfy these two requirements, if they're convex and they're between 0 and 1. And then, so a whole measurement is just a set of these effects. So I'm going to note that by MK, where each one of these guys is an effect. So this is a and one requirement on a measurement is that if we sum over mk over all k, this is equal to 1. So they have to give proper probabilities, they have to be normalized on all states. So I should give you some examples of this before going on. I think. So here's one example. So this will be our state space. So we have just an arbitrary convex set. And this lives in R2. And the states are just anything in this convex set. And if we take, for example, a state on the boundary omega and another one phi, then when we take convex combinations of them, we just get things inside. on a line in between them, depending on the probabilities that we mix them with. And if we take an effect, so a measurement outcome, there will be certain states that give probability 1 and others that give probability 0. So for example, we can take something like this. So if we have mk equals 1, it's just this guy. And then we have this guy over here is the state which gives mk equals 0. So in general, for any measurement outcome, we have these two affine hyperplanes acting on the state space. So anything on this line, anything in the vector space on this line evaluates to 1 on mk, but the only valid states that valid to 1, for example, is just this guy here, and similarly here. And everything in between gives a probability between 0 and 1. So for example, an n-level quantum system, if I were to think of it in this abstract way, we have the set of states. So let me just start. We have the d-dimensional complex vector space, and then I'm going to let H d be the d squared H sub d is the space, the real vector space of Hermitian operators, which is d squared dimensional. So in this is our vector space A in this abstract setting that I talked about above. So it's a real vector space in which all the states live. So the set of states for this quantum system is just the density matrices. Right? So we have rho in Hd, such that rho is positive and trace rho equals 1. And so I should have said that this set of all these effects, I'm going to call that E of A. So for this quantum system, E of A is the set of, let's call them M. So the set of all Hermitian operators which are positive and less than or equal to the identity. And then measurements in this framework are just sets of these effects, sets of these positive operators, which all sum to the identity. So that's the analog of this condition here, that you have normalized probabilities. So the last thing I need, I think, for the principles is how to describe transformations in this framework. Can everybody see if I write over here? And so, I'm running out of time. So transformations are just linear maps. On the vector space A, which map valid states to valid states. So let's say T is a transformation, then T of omega F of A. So I've kind of skipped a step. but I don't think I have time to cover it now. So instead of just defining normal transformations, I'm going to define reversible transformations. I'm going to forget about regular transformations. So let's say, and invertible, which preserve the state space. So in quantum theory, these are the maps of the form which take a density matrix through U, rho U, where U is an SUD. So these are the reversible transformations in quantum theory. And for more general theories, there can be many of them, there can be very few. It depends on the geometry of the state space. So the main point of talking about these geometric objects is that you can think of the state space and the effect space together with the transformations as encoding the physics. It in the same way that in quantum theory, the structure of the density matrices gives us all the quantum information and all the features that we have there, you have a similar kind of thing for more general theories. Depending on the theory, you have very different information processing properties of the theory and different predictions and that sort of thing. Okay. So, what do these things look like for the Jordan algebra? So I've shown you a little bit in this example what it is for the standard quantum theory. But we can define these state spaces for all the Jordan algebras. So for every Jordan algebra, we can define a set of states and effects and transformations. But since I only have 10 minutes left, I'm going to skip that. It's basically very similar to how it's done in the quantum case. For every Jordan algebra, there's a notion of a positive element of the algebra, and there's a notion of an inner product, like the trace. And we can define effects in a very similar way, and the transformations are also very similar. Okay, so I should state the principles before I run out of time. So the first one basically says that every one of our states can be written as a convex combination, so as a mixture of a special set of states, which are called perfectly distinguishable. So we have a set of states, omega 1, omega n, so if there is a measurement, let's call it EJ, with n outcomes, such that if we act on the state omega I with the jth outcome, we just get 1 or 0, depending on which state. So in the quantum case, a set of states is perfectly distinguishable if they all have mutually orthogonal supports. So if you have a basis for the underlying Hilbert space, those states are perfectly distinguishable, which just means that there's a special measurement that you can tell them apart with probability 1. So this is perfectly distinguishable. So then the first postulate is that all for all and the omega I are perfectly distinguishable. So this just says that every state, you can find some set of perfectly distinguishable states in terms of which you can write your original state. So this isn't saying that every state is prepared in this way, it's just a way to simulate every state. So there's a particularly simple way to prepare every state or to simulate it. So this is analogous to the spectral decomposition in the quantum case. Okay. the second.
Cosmin, is it true that you can prepare it in that way? Yeah, you're saying you don't have to prepare it that
way. Yeah, you don't have to, but you can, yeah.
You can.
The probabilities of all future measurements would be the same, no matter which way you prepare it. If you prepare it this way or some other way. So P2. So suppose we have some set of n perfectly distinguishable states, and we have another set of n perfectly distinguishable states. I call them omega 1 to omega n prime. The postulate is that there's a reversible transformation that takes this set to this other set. So there exists in a way, this means that if you have a, I should say that these are, so these are pure. And then the distinguishable states here are pure. I forgot to say that. And here as well. So if you have some pure state of your system, this postulate states that you can reversibly transfer it to any other system with the same number of distinguishable states. You just take your state to be one of these sets of perfectly distinguishable states, and you can reversibly transfer it to any other system. Okay, so using just these two principles, you can get quite far, and I guess I don't really have time to say, go into how far you can get to getting the Jordan algebra structure. But then for the last step, to actually define a product that's commutative, we need to introduce a third principle. So this one relies on a special kind of transformation known as a filter. And so in the quantum case, filters are, so I'll write it here, just to give you an example. They are maps that take density matrices to where P is a projector on the original complex Hilbert space. So this is the, you can think of this as the von Neumann projection rule, right? And in the quantum case, all filters are of this form. So in the general case, I'm going to define filters as any linear transformations P which are idempotent. So we want the state of the system after the filter to be, we want the filter to act the same way if we act twice, basically. That's what the squaring says here, just like in the quantum case. And we also want there to be a filter P prime such that P of some state gives us the same state back if and only if P prime of that state gives us nothing, it kills the state. And also that P prime of omega equals zero. So this P prime is a kind of complementary filter to P, so a complementary transformation. So in the quantum case, P prime is the map that takes rho to 1 minus P. So this is a filter, and the postulate is that filters take pure states to multiples of pure states. So in the quantum case, if you have a map of this form and you put in a pure state, any pure state, then what comes out will be a real multiple of another pure state, right? So if we take the pure state psi and we act with P, then what we get is lambda phi so we just get some probabilistic multiple of another pure state. So that's the third principle, basically. So there's you can define this kind of real multiple of states in this general framework, and I don't have time to go into that. But just imagine this statement generalized for this framework. So
so just by multiples of pure states, do you mean something more subtle than just this direct interpretation as it returns some pure state with a probability?
Yeah, that's one way to interpret it. Yeah. I just mean that if you want to make it more mathematically precise, you need to introduce this idea of a cone that I don't have time to go into. So the distinction is between taking the set of normalized states in the quantum case and comparing that to the set of all states, subnormalized and supernormalized. So the set of all just positive matrices, right? So there's an analogous structure in the general case. And that's the only way you can really talk about multiples of states, right? If you introduce this extra structure. But so I was going to say a little bit about the kinds of things that 1 and 2 imply and then how 3 plays a role in defining the product. But maybe I'll just say one thing about 3. And how what role it plays in defining this product, and how the product is actually defined. So just from postulates 1 and 2, we can derive that the set of states has a very simple structure and it has a lot of filters on it. So you can imagine theories where, given the definition of filter that I have here, there just are no filters. There are no positive maps that are idempotent and satisfy this. But from 1 and 2, we can show that there are a lot of these. And in particular, there's one of these for every face of the state space. And what I mean by a face is a set of states that gives 0 on some measurement, basically. So in the example up there, that flat piece is a face. And all the other points on the curved piece, those are also faces of the state space. In the quantum case, faces are basically, if we take all states and input them into a map like this, the resulting convex set is a face. Right. So they are states with some rank smaller than the maximal rank. Those are faces. So we can show in general, just like in the quantum case, that for every face, there's one of these filters. And in particular, for every pure state, so for every state of the state space that cannot be written as a convex combination of other ones, that's what I mean by pure. In particular, there's one of these filters for that pure state. Just like in the quantum case, right? We have the state psi and the corresponding projector. We have a similar structure following from 1 and 2, postulates 1 and 2. And so if we have, let's say, omega pure, okay, I'll let P sub omega be the corresponding filter, and then I'm going to define a product by saying that omega star some element B, where B is just anything in A. This is just 1/2 of the identity on A plus P omega minus P prime omega acting on B. So just given postulates 1 and 2, we can define a product like this. And then where 3 plays a role is in showing that this thing is commutative. So quantum case, if you expand all of this out, this ends up being a map of that form, P rho P. And then using this product just for pure state, so remember this product is only defined for pure state here, so an extremal element of this set of states. Using this product, we can define a more general product, which ends up being the Jordan product, but that only follows from P3. Okay, I guess I should finish up.
Can you say a little word about how that procedure works in the case of quantum theory?
Which procedure?
Of going from the product P rho P to the anti-commutator product. Pure space.
So if B is like a rho in the quantum case, and remember that this map P sub omega acts on basically the vector space of Hermitian operators, and it takes states into faces. So I think you just have to expand it out. Right. Once you define this product, and then you show that it has all the properties of a Jordan product, and then you classify all the Jordan algebras, that's sort of how it comes out in the end.
That product there is not the Jordan product.
It's a special case of the Jordan product. So this product is only defined for a pure omega here. In general, we want something like this, A circle B, where both of these guys are just any elements of the full vector space, not just the state space. And the way you do that is you take this product along with postulate 2. So basically, you take any element and you expand it out in terms of a set of distinguishable states, and then you use this product. And that's how you define this one.
So what I'm still confused about is that the Jordan product in quantum theory, you said earlier, is the anti-commutator.
Right.
And you said this star product for pure quantum states is essentially projector on the first quantum state.
I didn't mean to say that, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. It's this guy.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. I think I'm supposed to spoke there.
Oh, okay. I got it.
Yeah. So the action of P sub omega on B is P rho P in the quantum case.
I see.
Okay. So I guess I haven't had a chance to really go into the other things that one and two imply, or really how this product works and why P3 is necessary, except very vaguely. But I think what's interesting about these axioms is that it seems like one and two get us very far towards the Jordan algebra structure, and it may be possible to just get rid of three. And P3 has actually showed up in other reconstructions, so Lucien Hardy's most recent one. He has something very similar, a very similar restriction on his filters. So either it's possible to get rid of it, which I think would be interesting, that we can just get this Jordan algebra structure from 1 and 2, or we absolutely need it to get the Jordan algebras, which would suggest that there are theories that satisfy 1 and 2, but they don't satisfy 3, that are not Jordan algebras. So those might be interesting, because 1 and 2 are fairly simple, and they contain a lot of symmetry, which we might want of a physical theory. So it sort of suggests a way to go beyond the standard quantum picture while still retaining a lot of its features, except this one small part, P3. So the other thing I wanted to say is that we haven't used composite systems at all in this. I haven't said anything about how systems combine in local tomography, which is one of the usual assumptions that people make. So it might be interesting to think about dropping P3 and adding local tomography to 1 and 2 and seeing if we get the usual complex quantum theory rather than this more general algebraic structure. So I think I should just